there, that's not Montgomery County and that's not Arlington either.
I think there'd be broad disagreement with that statement.
Well, I'd add to that and not take away from the utopia comment, because I, of course, agree with that. But I would say to his no, I would say yes, even though we're really, our positions are pretty close. And I'd remind you of the slide where I said, here we're having the technical meetings and sitting at that table is the head of Public Works, a woman from WMATA, et cetera. It's important to set up your charrette process to bring those people in and try and confront those technical issues immediately. And we always try to do that. I think it literally never works 100%, but you get further and further there. And I think it's important to realize that as a kind of as a society and bureaucracy, there's this incredible inertia for the way we used to do things, where the different disciplines were so separate, they had their own little silos or little castles, and now we're talking about bringing them together and actually changing who's sits on the throne, getting the community vision to be first. And it just, there's so much inertia to that being that way. To get it to change is really tough, certainly because this is 2007 and we're in Montgomery County. You should be in better shape, and certainly given the way that the county's approaching form-based codes, which is looking in advance how it's going to affect the other sectors. And also, you get the experience of Arlington County. So it takes time to change all those practices, and you have to keep trying a little bit. It's like turning a barge around with a tugboat. It takes a while to get it going.
I want to move to some of the pent up questions that have been written down. First one here is that Roger, do you agree with Lee that green building components and other elements should be in the code as opposed to incentives? And if you don't agree, or if you do, why?
Excuse me. Coding for sustainability, I think, is actually going to be upon us whether we want it or not in the not too distant future. I just finished serving a year on the Anacostia Waterfront Corporation, now dissolved, Environmental Design Standard Committee. And our committee was charged with writing environmental design standards for all projects that are part of the Anacostia Waterfront Initiative in the District of Columbia. Some of you may know what I'm referring to, but it's a lot of property. And that set of standards, we sat down and looked at everything from Portland's code to others remaining nameless, and came up with a really aggressive set of standards, which basically we actually focus primarily on stormwater runoff, just to give you a little bit of background, affecting the Anacostia River. So much of the thrust of our design standards there had to do with stormwater water quality. We learned, for example, during this exercise that the new baseball stadium being built in D.C., they were just going to take all the stormwater runoff and dump it into the existing combined. So they made no provisions at all. We did finally, incidentally, get them to put in a few thousand square feet of a green roof. I think that there are different levels of greenness. Some of you may also know that in addition to the LEED standards that are applying to buildings, the U.S. Green Building Council has recently, in working with CNU and others, developed a set of standards for planning, community, residential communities. So that's a long answer to a short question. I think there is definitely a place for specificity about sustainable design, both at the urban planning and the architectural levels. I think that the as to how far we should go with that in Montgomery County, I haven't given it any thought at all, so I don't want to go any further than to say I think there's a place for it. It does have infrastructure impact. There are reasons to do it that are very pragmatic reasons to consider sustainability standards.
Any other members of the panel want to chime in on that? To what extent should the things be required?
Well, I guess my principal point to take away from that discussion was not necessarily to pick on any given instance, but really to simply say that the fair and equitable way to effectively ask for a community benefit from a private developer is to ask for it from everybody. And the notion of negotiating it on a case-by-case basis is very frustrating. We'll never reach a community norm at that point. We'll have uneven and unequal treatment. And so if we really decide that we want a certain thing, whether it's a level of stormwater protection or something else, you know, those are the kinds of things that we ought to code for. The development community will provide better buildings sometimes than we actually code for as a minimum. It's actually possible to get a building that exceeds the minimum. It is done sometimes. But the code is really about what's the minimum community standard that we expect from everyone. And in the interest of certainty, of transparency, et cetera, if you want it, ask for it.
My take on sustainability is to bang the same drum again about let's make sure that we don't cut our nose off to spite our face in terms of sustainability. Most of the rules or techniques that people know about and think about as far as eco-friendly or saving Mother Nature are kind of rural or suburban in nature. And if you apply those to a city, you'll end up damaging your city. And in fact, the most sustainable thing we can do is to build towns and cities, mixed-use towns and cities where people don't take up so much land area of the earth and don't have to get in a car and even if they're burning nuclear energy or magic dust, get stuck in traffic, et cetera, et cetera. So sustainability first, let's make sure we don't damage our biggest tool, which is making the city.
Let me just expand on this. There's a question here that builds on that point that we've been talking about. You've been talking about fairly standard things that could be required in the form-based code, but in Montgomery County, as you probably know, we have a number of extras for which density bonuses are frequently provided, such as additional affordable units, moderate price dwelling units. There's a density bonus that is available. There's a density bonus for transferable development rights. Now, with the latter, there's the problem of the developer having to buy those from a willing seller. So how do we figure things like this into form-based zoning and to make sure that we're getting the kind of public benefits that a master plan may call for?
Well, there's no reason not to, for example, code a building to four stories, you know, by default in the code, and eight stories with transferred-in units. I mean, that's possible to do. But there has to be an understanding in that process that this building might be anything between four and eight stories. And if the TDR system has not really been adequately set up to transfer those units in at some kind of a reasonable cost, then it won't become the eight stories. So I guess one of the things, to go back, for example, to the affordable housing question and off the more environmental protection or ag land protection question, in affordable housing, in some sense, you would be better off as a government, in my mind, being involved, more directly involved in all projects and getting affordability. And if the only trade-off to the developer is density, then you have to be ready for the final form that comes from building that density. Richard mentioned they're maximizers. So if they're building to that density, it's because it's financially feasible for them to do. That makes you a financial player in that game. If you can figure out what that dollar amount is, you can either have them do it, you can do it yourselves, you know, it can be moved around in a lot of ways. It's really the figuring out of what that increment that needs to be paid to get that that thing to appear in the marketplace. The other thing is that if possible, a form-based code in regard to residential density has none. Doesn't have a density equation. If you want to build huge units, you can, and a few parking spaces. If you want to build a lot of parking spaces and a lot of teeny tiny units, you can. Either concept is accommodated, and clearly the teeny tiny units are more affordable. It's just land cost and building cost expressed on a, you know, by unit, by square foot basis. You're intervening in the marketplace no matter what, but the form-based code is trying to stay policy neutral on that and simply let the marketplace respond to it in building a good urban form.
Another question that's been raised is, this would be very helpful, what three or four specific steps can Montgomery County take to implement the principles of form-based codes in our sector plans, and starting now?
Streets first.
I was going to give you two or three, but Lee took one of mine. I think the process that you're moving along right now, and actually you've already taken some of the first steps, which is as a community to start to get to be very involved and understand what's the difference between a good town and a suburb. Process like this where we start to introduce to the community and that includes citizens, developers, builders, et cetera, the idea of using these kinds of tools and this kind of a paradigm for development, and then moving towards it. One of the FAQs I was asked to comment on, but didn't get into my slideshow, is it better to apply form-based code to a big area or a small area? Certainly, it's for reasons of just pragmatics, it makes the most sense to apply it to a target area. It has a lot to do with everybody so used to doing things the other way. If it weren't for that inertia of expectation and bureaucracy, I think you certainly could code everything with a way that puts form first, including single-family detached. But it's just not at all practical. I think the first steps would be first projects that become demonstrations and learning experiences, although I would say there's less to learn now thanks to Columbia Pike.
I was going to make a comment about that similar to yours, Jeffrey, when you got onto the subject of areas. It seems that one of the things that could be undertaken right away is, in fact, to go and identify those sites, those sectors, those areas of the county that most clearly would be candidates for form-based coding, because I know enough about the county and I've practiced in the county enough to know that there are areas where, while I would like to see form-based coding, the land use patterns, the density, the infrastructure patterns, et cetera, are such that the cost-benefit equation wouldn't be satisfied in the near term. So if we can talk about near-term, mid-term, long-term planning, I think it would be a fairly logical first step for us to take a look and say, where do we really need right away to look at applying this? And it seems to me that even without a map in front of me, we could probably sit here in 30 minutes come up with a pretty good list.
That leads to another question here, is how can master plans best and sector plans best inform the development of form-based code?
We've talked about this on behalf of Prince George's County, and we're trying to craft a system for them that would, in theory, operate for you equally well, because they use the sector planning process in a very similar way. But the notion is that the end product of a sector planning process needs to be perhaps a little more physically specific than it has been in the past. At this point, we're talking about something that might be called a framework regulating plan, something which would exist between the fully detailed plan that a developer might prepare, that would also set in place some form of you know, network of major roadways, resolution of sort of major issues for an area in a very physical way, which many of our sector plans don't quite get to now. That's maybe one to watch for you guys. Draft of that material is due in about January or February of this coming year, so it's fairly swift.
Yeah, I think combining answer to the last question and this one, I think part of the process of starting to think about how to apply form-based code to projects that are just getting started is a public education process. I think just as planners need to understand that, I think it's really a process of starting to communicate to the people with who will be involved in the sector plans, the public, about how is this different? How should we start thinking about form in our community? What are the aspects that we have to start addressing to think about that? What are the options that we have? And in planning, we start doing that by thinking about what constitutes form in an area so that when we're working on a sector plan, the form base is not an overlay over the vision. It actually becomes part of the vision for that community, and the vision is looked at and interpreted in a form-based structure.
And I was wondering if Melissa had planted that question, because just starting on a white paper that's going to make a recommendation for exactly that. That sounds like the contract language, but I don't want to talk about it too much because we're too freshly into it. But at base, you're talking about master plans, and most places have already started to do this. It's just a natural, if you're working with citizens, talking about envisioning what the future is going to be, what they want their neighborhood or their neighborhood main street to be as it evolves, what they want to preserve, what could change in a positive way. I don't think they're talking about various shades of ochre or blue with hatching that are CR2 apostrophes. You know, they're not talking in abstract terms. They're having drawings that are made that they make or that they make for them. They're talking about a kind of vision of a physical place, and a master plan needs to gather as much of that kind of information as it can. And indeed, that's what we do on these public participation charrettes. We get citizens drawing, and then we have some professionals helping take their drawings up to a next level as a way of citizens saying, this is really what we want.
And Jeff, could you talk a little bit about when you prepare for a charrette? Obviously, there needs to be a certain number of or a body of information about what the constraints and overall goals are for a particular area. You can't go out and say, well, let's just vision for this area, and folks will vision, well, we want, you know, 8-story buildings, when we know it's an area that isn't transit served. It isn't one of the areas we wanted to have 8-story buildings in. You know, there are constraints that are both, traffic related, and that relates to an earlier question. There are constraints that are economic. There are constraints that are environmental. How do those get factored into your charrette process? Is that communicated at the outset, or?
Yes, and throughout the core conceit of this process is that the really core conceit is that an informed citizenry makes the best decisions. It's that basic democracy thing. So it's very important that you go to great lengths to make sure that all the information and all the knowledge is at the table. You've got citizens who are developers, economists, people who are, developers know a thing or two, kind of seat-of-the-pants rules about what the local economy will do. You may bring in an economist who will see it from a broader perspective. You've got the environmental folks, the traffic folks. In an ideal conversation, you've got sitting around those tables representation of all the stuff that's going to happen and influence and shape what the place can be. And you often find, we were doing a charrette in Peoria, which has a little bit different, I think the decimal place has moved over at least one spot on the growth rate in Peoria. It's a little bit low, but we're working on the downtown. We had some economists that we work with quite a bit, and they were finding as we were working, and we're working with the public, and then thereafter, the week after, they got smarter and smarter, and it actually was a much better situation than at first glance you would have thought. And that some of the local people, they thought, oh, it's dead, but actually it wasn't. But bottom line, you bring everybody to the table. There's a certain amount of things you can learn ahead of time, where if there's a sinkhole, you don't build there. You know, kind of buildable area things.
I do think, though, that you have to kind of decide which are true constraints and which are simply facts to be dealt with in the planning process. Great example would be that 96-inch stormwater main. If they had taken that as an absolute constraint, they would have had to chop that building in two and left a, you know, a slice right through the center of it, which clearly would have been unacceptable to the landowner. It wouldn't have worked for anybody. And so while at first glance, you know, moving a 96-inch storm main seems like it's insane, in this instance, it really had to happen. So I think what we're talking about, we rarely call them constraints. You know, we try to put the facts on the table, and maybe in some instances we don't have enough of the facts, like where the real right-of-way edge is and some of those. But if we immediately start out thinking of those things as constraints, we've perhaps, you know, kind of collapsed the possible solutions beyond where we ought to be starting, at least in the planning process. That's what the technical people help us with as we work from plan to reality.
Yeah, Richard?
Yeah, I want to jump in on the idea of constraints. Just give you an example. When we were doing our street space plan, which again took us 8 months to get through, just to plan, you know, how wide the sidewalks are going to be, where the tree plan is going to be, whether we're going to have bike lanes or not. We understanding that transit was a major goal for Columbia Pike. We have existing transit. We're going to improve it in the future. Citizens ask, well, why can't the traffic lanes be narrower? VDOT and national standards would say that a lane should be no less than 11 feet. 12 feet is more optimal. And our citizens said, well, why can't it be narrower? And then we had to prove it. We said, well, when you look at the typical metro bus, which we operate now, it's 8 feet wide, and it's got a 1 foot wide rearview mirror on each side. They said, well, take the mirrors off. They said, well, you know, buses in the future don't have to be that wide, do they? You know, so there's an element of, you know, listen and accept that, you know, sometimes get lost.
I would really want to throw in there, though, despite that, pushing the edges of intelligence, in all the processes I've been involved with, we found, you put these citizens and developers are citizens too. You put citizens, environmentalists, et cetera, at tables and ask them to propose holistic solutions. And I've yet to be at a charrette where somebody said, well, let's just put a big bubble over the city so we don't have to deal with the rain or the snow.
I've been in that meeting.
outlandish solutions. It's just amazing how they don't come up and how the citizens work towards solutions that really take into account some basic levels of economics. They didn't quite get the construction types, but there's an argument for, you know, that construction types may change over time. So yeah. They give them six stories, and it's clumsy, tough beans. But yeah. But citizens in that situation are really smart, and actually they always surprise, I think, the developers at how reasonable they can be in that situation.
Yeah, Dina?
I think that it's important to emphasize that the charrette is the heart of that process, but it's not the be-all and end-all of the process, that there has to be work done to understand the constraints before you get to the charrette process. If you want it to be a successful process, there has to be work done after the charrette process in terms of communicating where you are with the plan. And so I think it's an important part in efficiently and effectively developing that plan and communicating among all the players, but it's not the only part.
But is it an essential part of the, in other words, does form-based coding presuppose a charrette process?
I would say yes, but it's the case of the exception proves the rule. And we did a project in Farmers Branch, Texas, where they we did know Charette. They had done a more conventional series of public involvement sessions and a speaker series. It was actually very well done, but it was not a Charette. I would still tend to think of that as the exception that proves the rule and not the exception that means there is no rule. A charrette is just seems to be far and away the best way of focusing and recording the political will of the community.
I think even when you're dealing with large-scale greenfields, brownfields, grayfields sites, that the charrette process, the short feedback loops, the involvement of the multiple parties, et cetera, is really key to having a tight code that is publicly acceptable. And wherever we have tried to short that process by a day, by $10,000, by whatever, we've really found ourselves frustrated. It is one of the keys to successfully planning and coding small areas.
One other question. I noticed all of the pictures that you showed us of form-based learning. Tend to be pretty beautiful sort of Main Street operations. How does one of the questions that came in was how does form-based code deal with interesting uses like gas stations and drive-ins and other typical uses that have traditionally been considered special exceptions?
We actually have some, and we didn't show. We could keep everyone here for hours and hours, given the chance, but we won't do that. We actually have some there drawings, things from particular projects that show examples of how to, and here's the point, work within the constraints of the form-based code and do a drive-in. Essentially, and it's an example. Some codes will say no drive-ins, but what if instead of saying no drive-ins, you just come up with, as is the idea of the form-based code, what it takes to make a good street space, to do a drive-in on what we can almost visualize as kind of traditional American Main Street. Well, the drive-in, you're not going to have a 70-foot hole in the street with the stanchions and the cars driving in and out. You'd have to put the drive-in maybe on an alley or around behind the building so that it's the circulation is through an interior parking lot. One view is give them a set of standards to make a good street, and if they want to figure out a way to do a drive-through or a gas station in that, they can. The second level of that is if you're talking about in maybe a looser area on the edge of the city, you may have specific standards for those and treat them as special exceptions. We have a number of colleagues who have drawn designs for a technique dealing with the gas station that they like to call gas backwards. The basic idea being instead of having the gas station hiding inside the block in the back of the lot with the pumps out front, bring the building out to the corner or the street where the building itself is a billboard, and they always have that little quart of milk and all those candy bars you can buy, and have the gas pumps on the inside so you preserve more of the street edge and bring the working stuff inside.
Can I comment on that? I think this question illuminates once again the critical nature of being or the critical need to be site specific and to look at every, in a way, every condition as a case unto itself. But I'm thinking about the number of times I've seen this gas station over in Roslyn that is sitting under a church. Some of you may have seen it. And every time I go by it, I then remember the gas station in Houston where I grew up. There was a gas station in Houston that was under a building. And always wondering, well, you know, if we get a 3-hour rating on the overhead, you know, why aren't we doing that more often? And there may be one place in Montgomery County where that might make sense, or three places that might make sense. I think that this question points out how important it is to have a macro plan framework plan for a fairly substantial area, whether it's a sector or the whole county. But you need this nesting of plans, this layering of planning that goes from the macro to the micro. And I think it was said by someone earlier that what we've tended to do is we've tended to be very macro in our traditionally in doing our planning, and basically completely relinquish the micro and the intermediate between micro and macro to the developer. And I say that as a practitioner who spent the first 10 years of his practice doing that. I mean, I've done projects in Prince George's County, and I've done projects in this county and other places, and almost every time I'm given a big piece parcel of land when I'm doing work for mostly residential developers, and I get to decide where the streets are going to be, and I get to decide where there's going to be a gas station, etc. And that's what I think we're suggesting needs to be changed, and what form-based coding can do. But it's got to be done. Once you get beyond the macro framework, it's got to be done very site-specifically.
I want to go back to there are a couple of questions that have been brought up that are similar to the one that Mark asked earlier. And I'm going to put both of them to you. One asks, is it realistic to expect a neighborhood or community to be able to provide all the jobs, retail, and services for its residents with little or no involvement with automobiles? And a similar question asks, how do we balance the form-based code idea with our adequate public facilities ordinance that limits density to the number of cars that can be accommodated in the either of intersections or in a general area?
Wait, can I
Jeff first?
Can I do the first? Mm-hmm. Is it reasonable to expect each neighborhood to be? My interpretation of the question is sort of wholly self-sufficient. The people who work there, sleep there, and go to church there, etc. And the answer is no. But when you start to get these neighborhoods together in a town, you start to get these cross-fertilization isn't the right concept, but actually it is the right concept, just a bad choice of words. These things start to work together synergistically, and that's that kind of people are commuting this way, people commuting that way. First of all, distances are more likely to be pedestrian and certainly bicycle friendly, but that's the kind of environment where transit works best. Right now, there's a clumsy situation on the lines that go out into Virginia that in the morning, the rush hour in, the trains coming in have people packed in there like sardines, and the trains going out are pretty empty because that's the sleeping zone. And, you know, D.C. is the working zone. You start to mix that. Even if you just have some people going back, you've doubled the capacity of that transit line. The same logic happens with streets. So you're talking about, you know, if you 14 trips a day, if you can bring that down to 7, you effectively have doubled the capacity of that street, taking that many trips off it.
I think that having watched Florida dig themselves into this hole for a long time, any community that relies on traffic capacity as the sole descriptor of whether development or the principal descriptor of whether development ought to be possible or not is really fundamentally doomed to live with inadequate traffic capacity forever, because you won't be focused on the right kinds of things. You won't be doing the right things with were you to get funding, you'll be funding the simplest answers, which are not the best long-term answers. And I think a lot of people have told us for years and years and years, you frankly can't build your way out of congestion. And even the Florida model has since come around to admit that within downtowns and within developments of regional impact, there ought to be an idea that traffic inside can completely fail as long as traffic at the outside fringes continues to operate. So some ideas like that perhaps need to be imported into your system to give it enough flexibility to allow the form-based code areas to really build up. It's not to say that we want areas to have inadequate capacity. It's simply to say that We want the planning, the development, the capacity all to be thought about at the same time, and not for the capacity to be seen, as we were earlier talking about, as a constraint to what we want to have happen in a certain area.
Just to add on that a little bit, I think Yogi Berra said that place is so crowded nobody goes there anymore. I mean, if it's a place where people want to be, that's where they'll be. So I think you should aspire to that, you know, to that goal, regardless of these arbitrary standards. One of the things that we've done on Columbia Pike, understanding our commitment to transit, is part of that is that we are committed to getting more people to use transit. So, you know, buses are out there on Columbia Pike and they're well used, but as a form of transportation, it's less desirable than streetcar. And so that's why streetcar is the alternative that we're working towards. So more people will use it, and more developers want to build around it, and those sort of things sort of feed upon each other. The other thing is looking at alternate routes to get from point A to point B. We're actually enhancing the street network by creating parallel streets to take some of that capacity. So some of the local traffic. One of the issues that our citizens said was, you know, it's all those Fairfax people, you know, heading into town. You know, if we can get them out of here, you know, there'd be more street available to us. Well, partly true, but looking at the traffic data, a lot of that is local trips. You know, and if you can cut down on those local trips, if people can actually walk, you know, from their residence or their workplace to, you know, to lunch or whatever they're doing, that gets that many more cars out of there. So, you know, there's a lot of things you can do at the same time as you create this vision for the future.
Can I? Let me, I think I wrote about this a couple of times in the Washington Post. There's a philosophy, this picks up on Lee's point, there's a philosophy, we've seen it at work in Midtown Manhattan, and I've often thought maybe this makes sense, which is, you know, Midtown Manhattan, some of you may know, there's a district in which there's a limit on the amount of parking that's allowed in buildings. Developers can build a huge building, but they can only park 150 cars. You could make the argument that what we should really do is let the friction that exists get even worse in the traffic system, so that ultimately the cost of getting in your car and driving to go get a loaf of bread or buy a carton of milk becomes the cost in time, if not gasoline, becomes high enough that you finally have an incentive, economic incentive and psychological incentive, to get out of the car and walk or ride a bike or carpool. I think that, in other words, you can make the argument that we should absolutely not necessarily increase lane capacity, but leave things just as they are and let that friction help motivate people to change their behavior. Just one other point, ULI just published a report on America's infrastructure. I don't know if any of you have seen this. Very sobering document. I think the United States got a D minus or a D in the report. But it was a fascinating document that has many charts in it, all of which are very simple and easy to read. One of them is the chart that shows over a very long period of time, I think 3 decades, 30 or 40 years, the lane mile graph line goes up at a rate of about, I don't know, at a grade of about 10%, and the traffic miles driven line is about four times as steep, it's very clear. It's just an extremely revealing diagram that shows that, in fact, for quite a few decades, we haven't even come close in terms of building lane miles to absorbing the amount of vehicle trips. So maybe that's good. Maybe that's what we should be looking at. And otherwise, our behavior isn't going to change.
I'm going to read one more question, which or actually a couple of questions that came together. And we take a very short break, and then Roger and I'll come back and try to summarize today's discussion. But how does a form-based code address the concern of providing and maintaining existing communities such as everybody says we want to maintain. And a related question to this, of course we have none in Montgomery County, is how do we turn NIMBYs into stakeholders?
Let me jump in on this, because I've actually been out here to the county working with at a conference a year or two ago. I don't remember which one it was. 3 years ago, talking about mansionization. I mean, for example, we were talking earlier about what things could we do right away, and I mentioned identifying places where firm-based coding would make sense in the near term. It seems to me there are a lot of neighborhoods where the citizens, the property owners, are very concerned about the velocity with which properties are being acquired and houses torn down, the tear-down phenomenon, followed by the arrival of the McMansion, or whatever you want to call it, which has the consequence of course, changing the nature, the character, the feeling of the fabric of such neighborhoods. And this is certainly one of several kinds of neighborhoods or communities that look different from many of the slides that we showed, which were mainly Main Street, where in fact form-based coding can make tremendous sense, where you might come in and adopt an overlay or use whatever the appropriate mechanism that says, okay, you know, we're going to declare this. You might have to declare an area landmark it or somehow identify it and give it special status and say, okay, in this area, we're going to introduce a form-based code that says you've got to respect certain parameters of dimension and mass and scale and so forth. I mean there's a whole spectrum, in my opinion, that includes with Main Street sitting there, but there are a lot of other kinds of neighborhoods and streets on that spectrum where a form-based code, which would look very different for the middle of Bethesda than it might look for suburban Rockville. So that's something very important to keep in mind.
There's a project like that underway with somebody that Jeff and I are working with across the country, Nori Winter, in Chevy Chase right now. So there's maybe one to watch as an example of form-driven standards to deal with mass and scale of residential infill. And you're right, that's a hot-button issue in a lot of places.
I think the answer to both one and two are intertwined. And I've been saying this for a while at conferences, and no one's told me, no one's cut my feet out from underneath me yet. But I would suggest there's a problem from the point of view of a citizen. If you're looking at the way things are done, they tend to be at two extremes. One is they're either so kind of vague and indiscernibly apple pie, like at the level of the comp plan. They talk about all these good things that are you can't object to and everybody likes. They're all good. So why get excited about them? Or at the other extreme, they're so tiny and pick a unit. It's like looking at something through an hygrometer. You just see a little piece of it. And I think that's where the developer unveils his project and the citizens react to it, generally negatively. I think a lot of the source of NIMBYism is, as a citizen, there's too much precedent for give them an inch and they'll take a mile. And in a lot of the planning process, in public participation, you're dealing with just this inch without really looking holistically at how it fits into the neighborhood, et cetera. And there is a real fear. It's so logical. You should expect people to be afraid of, if we give them an inch, they'll take a mile, especially with the tendency under Euclidean zoning for some time now of kind of justifying one lot becoming commercial or more intense because the lot next to it is that intense. So it's sort of like a cancer, whatever that use is spreading. Setting up, and this is, you could do a form-based code in a different way, but we always aim to do form-based codes in a way that looks at a larger area. So if you're a neighbor and you live on Columbia Pike, one block or two blocks off the pike, as most, those people were involved, they saw a plan that was promoting development right on the pike, six stories, etc. But it transitioned, the next layer was three to four, and then it transitioned. We were showing them. It didn't make it into the final plan, but a code for those neighborhood houses. And they see it all as all those pieces work together, and that's the way a traditional town needs to work. And what we continually find, and that's the reason in the charrette process, part of that citizens seem to be just really smart as a collective and accept more density in some places because they're also seeing how that is balanced out by their own home and how those two things work together.
I also think that the communities that I've seen established through form-based code, it knits the communities together rather than, take Columbia Pike, for example. You had a corridor that, have a corridor that really divides one side of the street from the other. The form-based code has talked about bringing people to Columbia Pike to use it in community type building types of ways that they would not come and do right now. To walk more, to use shops, to shop, to live on that street, et cetera, in ways that they're just not doing now.
I would look at NIMBYism. I always have thought that there was an element of it that had to do very simply with lack of trust by citizens of the process and the participants in that process who are running the show. I mean, I think that there is, therefore, a tremendous need, not only for the process, whatever it is, to be transparent, but to really make sure that it's that this is not just window dressing. That is to say that the people, the citizens of a community, truly feel authorship. At the end of the day, when Kimmins was done, I remember. Andres called me and Joel Family called me and said, why don't you come around here? You wanted to write an article about this. So I went out and I wrote an article about the charrette at Kentlands. And the cartoon I drew, maybe there are a couple of people who remember it that appeared with it in the post, show a whole bunch of people in a room at the end of a process. They're all sitting in a room like this, and there's a screen up in front, and the image of the plan of Kentlands, and every person in the room had the same thought balloon, which was, geez, my ideas are in there. That's my work. But I think that that's one of the other reasons why charrettes and participatory planning is so critical. But we have a long history, though. We have a long history of people seeing deals being made, whether it's perception or reality, seeing things happen that make them distrust what they're hearing from the people who seem to be in control of the process.
On that happy note, let's take a very short break, about 5 minutes, just to refresh ourselves, and then we'll come back for a summary. If people will take their seats, we will conclude the session today. If everyone will be seated, please.
I'm going to turn the microphone over to Roger to make a summary, and I'll make a very few, and I promise, very short remarks following it.
This will also be short and sweet because I think my voice is near the end of its allotted time. I guess the first thing I would observe is that you probably are all going to walk out of this room. Can you hear me? I think all of you will walk out of this room knowing a lot more about what form-based codes are all about, what they do, how they can really much more effectively help you shape the built environment of Montgomery County than conventional or Euclidean zoning. And that alone, it seems to me, is a reason to seriously pursue the use of form-based coding. I think we've also heard a lot about how implementing it, how making it happen can be accomplished. It's one thing to talk about the theory of it, but the practicum is probably just as important as understanding the theory behind it. And the theory behind it isn't rocket science. It's just not. It isn't rocket science. It's very, very fundamentally about a community deciding what it wants its physical environment to be like. I doubt very seriously that any of you have ever attended zoning amendment hearings or here or in any other place where there was a substantial discussion, if any discussion, about urban design and architectural issues that we touched on today. It doesn't happen. It hasn't happened in many decades. There was a time when we did worry about such things. I can't help but think that when, for example, Oglethorpe laid out the plan for Savannah, Georgia, that there was probably some serious discussion, some serious dialogue about what the quality and character of that town would be given that plan. So I think that this, of course, gives to you some homework, because it means you've got to take a look at your community and say, well, what would I really like this to be like? What is going to be the nature of this place in the future? I think we didn't talk as much as we might about the challenge we face here in this county in terms of remediation. That is, a lot has been done in Montgomery County, as elsewhere, that was a mistake. Much zoning, in my opinion, has been done over the years that was premature. I think someone asked earlier a question about or made a comparison between here and Europe. I've spent a lot of time in Germany, for example. They don't go out and pre-zone land outside an urban growth boundary, and there's usually a very distinct line between city and country, When development pressures reach a certain point, they move the line. It's not that they're against growth, but until a certain point, all growth at urban or suburban densities occurs within a prescribed area. We haven't done that in the United States. We haven't had to do it because we've been an automobile culture that also was a culture with plenty of landscape to abuse. So that's changing. You know, we have in Montgomery County an agricultural preserve. This county is urban. Much of this county is urban, I should say, not suburban anymore. And I'm referring not just to its geographic position, but I'm talking about the character of or the quality of activity and housing and employment and everything that's mixed in together. So you have a place that is has got a lot of city going on, but we all know that it's all been built under a set of rules and regulations that were never ever envisioned to be rules making for a city.
So how do you remediate this? How do you deal with the fact that you've got a whole lot of dead-end roads and cul-de-sacs and varicose vein networks and places where you can get Via Metro and places where you can't get Via Metro? So I think a lot of what faces this county is is remediation, is fixing what I consider to be things that, mind you, seemed like a good idea at the time when they were created. They're just no longer what you need today. They have become dysfunctional. I think this is typical of every jurisdiction in the United States. This is not unique to Montgomery County. Let me just make one other point, then I'm going to give this back to Royce. You really have a unique opportunity here. You've got political leadership willing to undertake this job, this task, and I think that in itself is often a hard sell. Back in the 90s, Mal Rivkin, who I think a number of you know, he and I were retained by Monroe County, Pennsylvania, to help them shape their 2020 comprehensive plan. This is Pennsylvania, a state where the counties have very little power, so all the power is in the townships. It took us 2 years just to get the supervisors of the 20 townships to meet in the same room at the same time. The political, there was no political leadership. It was a very, very difficult problem. You don't have that situation here. You've got, it seems to me, a willing and able political leadership, and I think you've got a moment that's unique. Take advantage of it, and start, as I said earlier, by figuring out where it is that form-based coding could be useful and helpful right away. That at the same time, I do think this office in this building can be looking at the more long range as well as the short range opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
I'd just like to add a couple of things. I think about what's occurred today. It reminds me of the old story or the old question, what are 5,000 lawyers on the bottom of the ocean? The answer to that is it's a good start. This has been a good start today, I think, for us begin to think about a different way, and in some cases a better way, of dealing with some of the problems that we're confronting as we develop master plans and as we revise the zoning regulations of the county to fit with, as Roger said, a new time. A new set of conditions that are quite different than those that confronted us when we were populating the county. We're now pretty heavily populated. The increment of additional population will be substantial, but it won't be anything like that which we have already got. So we're doing simultaneously some new stuff and redoing a lot of old stuff that didn't turn out all that great. So from that start, let's see how many old practices and approaches we can get down there with the lawyers on the bottom of the sea. So thank you all. Let's thank our panel, Jeffrey and Lee, Richard, Dina, and Roger. Thank you so much.